This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for September 16th, 2013. It wasn't a particularly exciting week until late Friday when the Internal Revenue Service issued final regulations on the repair regs, the deduction and capitalization of tangible assets, and proposed regulations changing the rules on the disposition of tangible depreciation. As a group, those have been referred to as the repair regs or the 263A regs. In any event, we're going to talk about those toward the end of today's program. But first, we have proposed regulations on the limitations on the importation of net built-in losses. This reconciles some conflict or apparent conflict between 334B1B and 362E1 that apply to some non-recognition transfers of lost property to corporations that are otherwise subject to federal income tax. Then we get clarifying treatment on the effect of preventive health care being offered in a high-deductible health care plan in Notice 2013-57. Finally, it appears the SINCAST litigation is settled, and the subject matter of that litigation finally settled in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals is whether or not an employer who contracts with an outside party to pay their payroll is the employer, or for purposes of FICA and FUTA, or whether the outside party making the payroll is the employer. The specific facts, of course, were that SINCAST paid the wages of employees who worked for more than one employer during the year, and the result was they were withholding FICA and FUTA, but they were not remitting it because they were deeming themselves as the employer. We'll talk some more about that anyway. Then we've got Laura Harris Winford, the second case in 2 weeks, in which an estate made a payment, did not identify it as a deposit, and lost a significant amount of tax because the IRS treated the amount as a tax payment, especially you make the payment with a request for extension. Questions and answers on the health insurance premium tax credit, which is in force now, by the way. An updated frequently asked questions on the individual shared responsibility provisions. The employer shared responsibility provisions have been postponed for 1 year until 2015, but the individual shared provisions take effect January 1st, 2014, and as of October 1st, individuals who are not otherwise covered with minimum essential coverage need to be about the business of getting insurance coverage. Then a new publication, an updated publication, 1546, explaining the Taxpayer Advocate Service. It's a slick presentation. It's not necessarily for professionals. It appears to be for the public, although I'm not sure that the public ever really accesses the Taxpayer Advocate. And then those final regulations on the deduction and capitalization of tangible assets and proposed regulations on the disposition of tangible depreciable property. It turns out to be a lot to talk about, so let's get started. Proposed regulations under Section 334B1B and companion regulations under 362E1 apply to some non-recognition transfers of lost property to corporations that are subject to the federal income tax. The regulations affect the corporations receiving the lost property in exchange for shares in an otherwise tax-free 351 transaction. 334B1B applies to corporate acquisitions of lost property in liquidations described in Section 332. Section 362E1 applies to corporate acquisitions of lost property in transactions described in Section 362A and B. That's not necessarily 351 transactions, but they are tax-free transfers of property into the corporation. The regs use a hypothetical sale analysis to identify importation property, which is property which is being imported, which could be lost property. Under this approach, the actual tax treatment of any gain or loss that would be recognized on a sale of the property, first by the transferor immediately before, and then by the acquiring corporation immediately after the transfer, to determine whether an individual property is importation property. The regulations fortunately include several examples that illustrate the approach. There's a modified rule if the hypothetical seller is a partnership, a small business corporation that's elected to be an S-corp, a grantor trust. In those cases, the determination is made by reference to the tax treatment of the gain or loss as taken into account by the partners, shareholders, or owners of the entities, and there's an anti-avoidance rule. The IRS and Treasury continue to study whether a look-through approach should generally be applied to trusts. Once the importation property has been identified, the acquiring corporation determines the aggregate basis that it would have in all importation property acquired in the transaction without regard to the anti-loss importation provisions of Section 362(e)(2). If the aggregate basis of the importation property exceeds the property's aggregate value, then the transaction is a loss importation transaction and subject to the anti-loss importation provisions. If the aggregate basis of the importation property does not exceed the property's value, the anti-loss importation provisions have no further application. And according to the proposed regs, determining whether a Section 362 transaction is a loss importation transaction is made by reference to the aggregate, the net aggregate amount of built-in gain and built-in loss in all importation property acquired from all transferors in the transaction. The regs will require reporting of all affected transactions wherein taxpayers must identify the basis and the value of property that might be subject to those sections. Notice 2013-57 clarifies that preventive health care required to be provided under a provision of the Public Health Service Act qualifies as preventive care that may be provided without application of the minimum deductible of a high deductible health plan. In order to make tax-favored contributions to a Section 223 health savings account, an individual must be covered under a high-deductible health plan and have no disqualifying health care coverage. A high-deductible health care plan must meet some requirements related to minimum deductibles but may provide preventive health care benefits without a deductible or with a deductible below the minimum annual deductible otherwise required by Section 223(c)(2)(a). Back in 2004, Notice 2004-23 and Notice 2004-50 provided guidance at that time on preventive health care benefits allowed to be provided by a high deductible health plan without satisfying the minimum deductible requirement in 223(c)(2)(a). But the Affordable Care Act came later. It added Section 2713 to the Public Health Service Act. That requires group health plans and health insurers offering group and individual health insurance coverage to provide benefits for some preventive health care services without imposing cost-sharing arrangements. This notice, 2013-57, provides that any goods or services that constitute preventive care under the 2004 notices will continue to be treated as preventive care for purposes of Section 223. It also clarifies that any new preventive services identified in Section 2713 of the Public Health Service Act will also be treated as preventive care under Section 223. So a high deductible health plan will not cease to qualify as long as it's offering preventive care with as an exception to the deductible. Next, and I garbled the introduction to this a little bit, the citation is Syncast Services, LP. The court of decision here is the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. This has been going on since 2002, so it's a long-running battle between the IRS and Syntex. Syntex is a statutory employer. It's a payroll service. Syntex pays employees on behalf of their clients. The clients, according to the court's decision here, are the common law employers, so that if Syntex pays an employee $60,000 when the employee works for Company A, and the employee moves to Company B, and Syntex pays them another $60,000 while they work for Company B, that Syntex cannot claim that Syntex is the employer and $120,000 worth of wages exceeds the FICA threshold and the FUTA. In a Syntex must treat the employee for FICA and FUTA purposes as though the employee worked for employer A, subject to the FICA and FUTA limits, and then worked for employer B, subject to the FICA and FUTA limits. There's about $43 million in play here, but I want to remind everyone that the ruling here, that the payroll service that's making the payroll is not the common law employer. They're the statutory employer. They're required to file all the forms, and they're required to remit all the taxes. But for purposes of FICA, for purposes of FUTA, and let's expand that for purposes of the health care credit, for purposes of determining wages for the qualified domestic production deduction. In all cases, it is the common law employer, the employer for whom the services are performed, that determines the wages actually paid to the workers when they're working for that employer. It is not wages paid by the payroll service for all the year, for all the period during the year, all periods during the year when they might work for more than one employer. Here's another sad case of the IRS winding up with money that really the executors of an estate didn't have to pay. This is Laura Harris Winford. A U.S. District Court, the Western District of Louisiana, Lake Charles Division, has held that an estate is barred by the Section 6511 limitations period from recovering an estate tax overpayment. The estate's remittance was an estimated tax payment and not a deposit, as demonstrated by the facts and circumstances of the case. The facts and the circumstances of the case are that at the time the tax return was due, the personal representatives estimated that the tax would be about $230,000, but they were involved in litigation with some of the heirs, could not determine the value of some property, so they filed a request for an extension and paid the $230,000 with the request for extension. They gave the IRS no written notice, no, that this was a remittance, that this was a deposit and not a payment of tax. The settlement was delayed by litigation for several years, more than three. By the time the litigation was settled, the personal representatives determined that the estate tax was only about $90,000, and so they had $140,000 coming back, but they can't get it. Revenue Procedure 2005-16 is quite clear as to the treatment of an undesignated remittance. And even though this case originated before 2005, you had Revenue Procedure 84-58 in effect then, and the wording was very similar. The lesson here is if you are making a deposit in order to stop the running of interest, you want to clearly designate that in a separate written instrument. You do not want to make a payment with a request for extension. Next, we have Q&A on the health insurance premium. And I'm going to read the answer to question number one, and my notes in the margin of my paper here say another complexity. I want you to think about this. What is the premium tax credit? The premium tax credit is an advanceable, refundable tax credit designed to help eligible individuals and families with low or moderate income afford health insurance purchased through the health insurance marketplace, also known as the exchange, beginning in 2014. You can choose to have the credit paid in advance to your insurance company to lower what you pay for your monthly premiums, or you can claim all of the credit when you file your tax return for the year. If you choose to have the credit paid in advance, you will reconcile the amount paid in advance with the actual credit to which you're entitled when you compute your annual tax return. I think that the note, another complexity that drives average taxpayers into the arms of the storefront return preparers, is just exactly the appropriate comment here. And they're just like a change in circumstance for a cafeteria plan, changes in circumstances may affect the amount of my actual premium tax credit. Increase or decrease in the household income, marriage, divorce, birth or adoption of a child, any other changes to the composition of the household, such as, let's say, an elderly parent becoming a dependent, and gaining or losing eligibility for government-sponsored or employer-sponsored health care coverage. This introduces another extraordinarily complex level of tax compliance to over 30 million taxpayers. And no one's really talking about what that means in terms of the complexity in the system. The politicians are arguing about other things, and you and I have to be concerned, but how are we ever going to calculate all this stuff? And how are we going to explain it? And do we expect the clients to understand it and give us the right information? You're eligible for the premium tax credit if you meet all of these requirements. You purchase coverage through the marketplace. You have household income that falls within the range of 100% to 400% of the poverty level. You're not able to get affordable coverage to an eligible employer plan that provides minimum value. You're not eligible for coverage through a government program like Medicaid, Medicare, CHIP, or TRICARE. You file a joint return if you're married, and you are not claimed as a dependent by another person. Now, this is going to introduce complexities not in the 2013 returns, but in the 2014 returns, so we have something to look forward to. Next, updated frequently asked questions, 6 pages of them, on the individual shared responsibility provision of the Affordable Care Act. The individual shared responsibility provision calls for each individual to have minimum essential health coverage, also minimum essential coverage, for each month, qualify for an exemption for that month, or make a payment when filing his or her federal tax return. The provision applies to individuals of all ages, including children, the adult or married couple who can claim a child or another individual as a dependent for federal income tax purposes is responsible for making the payment if the dependent does not have coverage or an exemption. The provision goes into effect on January 1, 2014, and the individual shared responsibility provision has not been extended. The employer shared responsibility provision has been extended, but the individual shared responsibility provision has not. That's an important thing to remember. It's also important to remember that as of September the 6th, we have updated frequently asked questions on the individual shared responsibility provisions, which would be helpful to anyone trying to explain all this to an individual client who does not otherwise have minimum essential coverage. Then we have a 25-page brochure titled Taxpayer Advocate Service is Here to Help. The first 9 pages explain the Taxpayer Advocate Service, and the last 16 pages give all of the addresses where regional offices are located, state offices are located, so that anyone who needs the taxpayer advocate can find them. Now, the repair regulations. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a special podcast next week covering these regulations in detail. But for right now, let's get a general notion of what's in here. The final regulations include a number of simplifications. Although they adopt the same general format as the temporary regs rules for materials and supplies, repairs and maintenance, capital expenditures, amounts paid for the acquisition and production of personal property, the final regs add a number of safe harbors and some simplification. The final regulations apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2014. However, some provisions are going to apply only to amounts paid or incurred in tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2015. In the alternative, the guidance provides that a taxpayer may generally choose to apply the final regs to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012, so early adoption is encouraged. The changes are going to make a real difference to taxpayers looking for greater simplicity in what I think we all perceive to be complicated rules. The final regs eliminate the temporary regulation ceiling to the de minimis rule, and provide that amounts properly expensed under a taxpayer's financial accounting policies are deductible for tax purposes. A lot of taxpayers believe that that aggregate ceiling posed too great an accounting burden and, frankly, too great a limitation. What the new regulations say, the final regulations say, is that a taxpayer with an applicable financial statement may rely on the de minimis safe harbor of the final regulations if the amount paid for property does not exceed $5,000 per invoice or per item as substantiated by the invoice. Those regulations also grant the IRS and Treasury to the authority to change the safe harbor amount through published guidance. So the de minimis safe harbor is now $5,000 per invoice if a taxpayer has a certified audited financial statement. But what about everybody else? Well, among other things, it's important to remember that we're talking here about a safe harbor. For larger companies, the guidance notes that if a taxpayer's policy exceeds $5,000, then the regulations say the exam team has the discretion to determine that the higher limit is acceptable. It's only a safe harbor, not a mandatory rule. There's also a de minimis rule for taxpayers that don't have an applicable financial statement. Under that rule, the taxpayer now has a threshold of $500 per invoice or item, replacing the $100 rule, because there's less assurance that the accounting procedures clearly reflect income. If the cost exceeds $500 per invoice or item, no portion of the property's cost is eligible for the de minimis safe harbor. Here it gets tricky. The final regulations clarify that that de minimis rule, the $500 de minimis rule, is elected annually by including a statement on the taxpayer's timely filed original federal tax return for the year to which the election is to apply. That's also true for the $5,000 de minimis rule. So you're making an annual election to claim the de minimis rule. Unlike the rule under the temporary regs that permitted taxpayers to select materials and supplies for application of the de minimis safe harbor, the final regs require taxpayers to apply the de minimis safe harbor, if it's elected, to all eligible materials and supplies in order to simplify the application of the rule. Now, with regard to routine maintenance, and our concerns here were really related to buildings, the final regs allow for a building itself to be capitalized as an improvement, and they stipulate a 10-year period as the time in which a taxpayer must reasonably expect to perform the routine maintenance more than once. Now, the depreciable class life of a building is generally 40 years. Many maintenance activities are not going to be undertaken more than once in 10 years. Think roof, right? The IRS is still standing between us and the opportunity to deduct the cost of replacing a roof. But the rules generally are going to be easier to administer. I look forward to spending an entire 20-minute program on covering the basics. And we're also going to try to put a webcast together. That'll run about 2 hours. We're going to really get into the details. A safe harbor election for taxpayers with gross receipts of $10 million or less allows qualifying small taxpayers to elect not to apply the improvement rules to an eligible building property if the total amount paid for the tax year for repairs, maintenance, improvements, and similar activities does not exceed the lesser of $10,000 or 2% of the adjusted basis, in which case the small taxpayer will simply claim the deduction. The final regs also clarify the distinction between a major component and a substantial structural part. A major component of a building is defined as a part, well, a major component of anything is defined as a part or combination of parts that performs a discrete and critical function in the operation of the unit of property. A substantial structural part is defined as a part or combination of parts that comprises a large portion of the physical structure of the unit of property. On the one hand, you're looking at what performs a discrete or critical function. Think the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning. On the other hand, a large portion of the physical structure of the unit of property would be, for example, the roof. It's going to take some time to sort all this out. The final regs expand the definition of materials and supplies to double the originally proposed $100 acquisition cost that you can deduct to $200. Small favors, right? And then there are two new revenue procedures coming to explain how we make automatic accounting method elections in order to implement these new regulations. Well, that's a wrap for this week. Remember, watch for a special on just devoted entirely to the repair regs in the way of a podcast, and then watch for a webcast, probably about 2 hours, to do every jot and tittle. Thank you for joining me this week, and remember, stay safe.